Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 2nd of July. I'm Barbara Miller coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. A funeral for a Thai teenager allegedly killed by an Australian man has been held in her home village. The body of 17-year-old Thancharnok Domhala was found in a suitcase in Pattaya on Thailand's east coast. 45-year-old Australian Simon Carman has been charged with her murder. Her family says it wants the harshest punishment for her killer. ABC correspondent Rachel Clayton reports.
Outside a Buddhist temple in Kalasan province in Thailand's northeast, monks perform funeral rites as the remains of Thancharnok Domhala are laid to rest. The temple abbot says hundreds of families attended the funeral.
There was a lot of people, her mum and dad, also the relatives. At the time when the body was here, even the parking lots were full. They felt sorry for her.
Thai police allege the 17-year-old was violently killed by 45-year-old Simon Carman inside his rented hotel room in the city of Pattaya before disposing of her body in a suitcase dumped near railway tracks. Mr. Carman denies the allegations. Pattaya Police Colonel Anek Sra Thung Yu says CCTV shows the teen arriving with Mr. Carman at his hotel, but she's never seen coming out.
She had only sent a message to her friend saying she had arrived. After that, she could no longer be contacted.
Thancharnok's great-aunt, Mi Boon Suert, says she helped raise the teenager and is struggling to comprehend her loss.
I'm just like a mother to her. She called me mum. Before she went, she told me she'd be back soon. I've raised her since she was 3 months old.
The 75-year-old says she wants the person responsible to face the death penalty.
If he can be killed, I want him to be killed like my niece. I want life for life.
Thancharnok's auntie, Miriti Thanachai, says she identified her niece's body.
Six of us went to the morgue. I was standing 1 meter away from the body. Her face was bruised and swelling. It turned dark. Teeth was broken, her head and hair was pulled.
Earlier this week, details emerged about Mr. Carman's movements the night he met the teenager. The manager of Marina 2 Bar and Grill in Pattaya says he appeared drunk.
He was drunk, yes. He walked, swaying side to side.
Police say Mr. Carman will remain in remand for up to 84 days while they build their case.
That was Rachel Clayton there. There's concern thousands of child sexual abuse survivors could miss out on compensation via the National Redress Scheme. The scheme, set up in response into the Royal Commission into Institutional Child Sexual Abuse, has a backlog of 30,000 applications, but is slated for closure in 2028. Advocates are calling for that timeline to be extended. Political reporter Claudia Long has more from Canberra.
For abuse survivor Chris Coombs, getting acknowledgement of the abuse he suffered and compensation from the scheme has been life-changing.
I got a call and I was informed about the successful outcome and I just wept. For me, the money component as well, it allowed me to go to law school.
And while he describes the gruelling redress investigation process as among his darkest days, it's also something he's desperate for other victim survivors to be able to access.
To finally share my truth, have it believed, have it recognised, and then to no longer have to pay for my own therapy felt like really important opportunity for healing.
Chris Coombs is a survivor advocate with the legal firm and support service No More, working directly with people navigating the redress scheme. But the scheme has a backlog of 30,000 applications, with more than 1,500 expected to roll in each month over the next year. No More CEO Jackie Mead wants the scheme extended beyond its planned mid-2028 closure.
I can't see any way that the scheme can actually meet the requirements for which it was set up, which obviously includes processing the applications of all of those people that came forward.
The federal government told the ABC it's made significant improvements to the scheme's operations, but in the first half of 2026, the scheme's processed an average of 993 applications a month. It's an increase on the previous 5 months, but that current rate of progress isn't enough to clear the existing backlog before the scheme shuts. Griffith University criminologist and former member of the Commonwealth Independent Advisory Council on Redress, Kathleen Daly, has studied redress schemes since 2012.
1 year to close the redress scheme after the close of applications is ludicrous.
In a submission to a Senate inquiry, the Department of Social Services said it could process all cases before the sunset date. Professor Daly disputes that.
All redress schemes, except very small ones, take more than a year to finalise applications.
She's also worried the department is underestimating the number of cases that will come in before the application deadline on July 1, 2027.
In the last 3 to 6 months, or in the last month of a scheme, there's a huge surge of applications.
It's numbers like these that have Greens Senator David Shoebridge echoing calls to push back the application deadline and extend the scheme.
All of those vulnerable survivors, many of them have finally worked up the courage and found the space, found the moment in their lives where they can come and speak about their abuse, they're going to be knocking on a shut door. We cannot let that happen.
Senator Shoebridge is a member of the parliamentary inquiry into the scheme's operation and says he's been frustrated with responses from the government during hearings. It's a sentiment that appears to be shared by WA Liberal Senator Dean Smith, who said this to the Department of Social Services at last week's session.
Outrageous is how I would describe that.
Right.
Because this committee took the department on trust that the performance of the scheme was better than the Auditor General's report revealed. Significantly better.
Social Services Minister Tanya Plibersek said in a statement, the federal government won't let victim survivors down and is focused on improving how the scheme operates so survivors receive outcomes sooner and with better support throughout the process. A legislated 8-year review of the scheme is now underway and has been tasked with providing advice to government on how to ensure valid applications can be processed before the closure date.
Political reporter Claudia Long with that report. And if you need support, help is available from Brave Hearts on 1800 272 831. Locals in far north Queensland are calling for greater border surveillance after a group of foreign nationals travelling by boat made landfall north of Weipa earlier this week. A Taiwanese man has now been charged over his alleged role in a people smuggling venture. Officers descended on the area after campers spotted the men in the early hours of Tuesday morning. Roseanne Maloney reports.
Sand whips into the air as a Border Force chopper ascends from a picturesque Cape York beach. Holidaymaker Dan Tonnen says word had quickly spread at his beachside campground when the boat came ashore in the middle of the night.
It freaked them out, as you can imagine. We don't really have any boats up this side pulling in at that time of night. And then one of them actually walked right into their camp.
It was a long night.
And so they hid in their tents and then actually hid in their car at one stage. And they went on for a few hours before the men, there was about 15 of them, they reckon, just walked into the bush and disappeared.
The boat contained at least 5 foreign nationals who were likely seeking asylum. Mr. Tonnen says their arrival earlier this week had unfortunate timing.
To be honest, if they had have probably not picked school holidays to come ashore, they probably would have got away with it.
The Australian Federal Police, Queensland Police and Australian Border Force have declined interviews, but issued a joint statement confirming a 34-year-old Taiwanese man has been charged over his alleged role in a failed people smuggling venture. He was arrested at a supermarket in Weipa in northern Cape York. Another 30-year-old man was also detained. Queensland Police Minister Dan Purdy says his officers have been assisting federal authorities to detain the group.
But this is an absolute embarrassment for the Albanese government. The federal government needs to secure our borders.
Boats with people seeking asylum rarely bypass Border Force's maritime surveillance measures to reach the Australian mainland, but it does happen. In February 2024, a group of 39 men from Pakistan, Bangladesh and India successfully made landfall at a remote beach near Beagle Bay, north of Broome in Western Australia. Months earlier, another vessel carrying a group of asylum seekers arrived undetected to the remote Anjou Peninsula, also in WA. This latest incident in Queensland has some Weipa residents remembering previous incidents being flagged by commercial fishers.
So if they look like foreign vessels, we used to ring, or we usually try to ring Canberra and get someone to see if they could check it out.
Lynette Olsen runs a seafood business in Weipa and used to run fishing boats off the coast there.
There's not many people that do a lot of fishing here now, so the coast is virtually open to whoever wants to come in.
The 34-year-old Taiwanese national will face Cairns Magistrates Court today.
That report by Roseanne Maloney and Oliver Gordon. The federal government is today expected to introduce its gambling ad legislation to Parliament, but it's already facing pressure to make changes. Political reporter Sarah Tomevska joins us now from Canberra. Sarah, what is Labor proposing and what amendments might it need to consider?
Good morning, Barbara. Well, Labor's legislation seeks to limit gambling ads to 3 per hour during daytime TV and early evening. It would impose a complete ban during live sports broadcasts, but no restrictions on gambling advertising after 8:30 at night. It's also seeking a ban on radio gambling ads during school pickup and drop-off times. Online ads for under 18s on social media platforms would also be restricted, and there'd be a requirement for social media platforms to offer opt-out systems for adults, as well as banning of gambling ads in stadiums and on jerseys once existing commercial and sponsorship contracts run out. Now, in order for the government to actually pass this legislation, which has been much anticipated and delayed by 3 years through the Parliament, it will need support from either the Greens and Crossbench or the Coalition. But there's no one in Parliament apart from Labor that believes this legislation goes far enough to protect particularly children from gambling harms. Now, the Greens and Crossbench senators like ACT Senator David Pocock are calling for amendments like setting up a national regulator to actually have oversight of the industry, as well as to ban inducements, which are when gambling companies offer people credits that they can only cash out, essentially, if they keep betting. Independent Senator David Pocock's been a particularly harsh critic of Labor's proposed reforms and says this is an opportunity for the Parliament to de-link sport from gambling.
The government needs to look after Australian children. This is an opportunity to actually stop the normalisation of gambling amongst Australian kids. We now know that 3/4 of Australian children think that gambling is just a normal part of enjoying sport. We should be enjoying sport for what it is, rather than just this opportunity to flog off a harmful product. And so I really am disappointed with the government's approach here, but I'm working with the opposition, working with the Greens in the Senate, and there's a real opportunity for the Senate to actually stand up and put Australians and Australian children ahead of vested interests.
Senator David Pocock there, and earlier Sarah Tomevska joining me from Canberra. It's been a source of debate and commentary for many years. Who's had it tougher, households of today or older generations who were paying mortgages when interest rates were in the double digits in the 1990s? New economic analysis from KPMG has found Australian households have faced greater mortgage pressure in the past 2 years than they did when the RBA's cash rate reached 17.5%, 17.5% in 1989. And Gen X, that's those in their mid-40s to early 60s who were paying mortgages through the global financial crisis, have experienced the greatest hardship in the past 40 years. Bridget Fitzgerald spoke to the report's author, senior economist Terry Ronsley.
Yeah, it's kind of a myth-busting exercise just to sort of help people understand across the last sort of 40 years when households have seen the biggest share of their income chewed up by interest repayments for their homes. And that's kind of where this has come from.
And what was it that you found?
Yeah, interestingly, we found that kind of the last couple of years, households have spent about 6% of their gross income on interest repayments. That's higher than that period when interest rates were around 17% in the late 80s. It was less than 6% then. But maybe interestingly, what we saw was that the period around the GFC from sort of 2006 to 2013, there was an extended period when interest payments were over 6%.
So it's a matter of our income versus our interest and our loans.
Yeah, so it's a combination of how expensive houses are, which means home loans have gotten larger. And over the last sort of 2 or 3 years, we've seen interest rates increase. So all those factors have sort of driven up the amount of interest being paid by households.
What was the data you analysed here? How did you reach this conclusion?
Yeah, so this is data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics and National Accounts, which they collect every quarter to work out how much money is flowing from the household sector interest into the financial sector.
So you mentioned the global financial crisis and how that burden heavily fell on Gen X households. What does that mean about those households who are still paying mortgages today?
Yeah, what we saw during that GFC period, the typical length of a loan sort of had gone from 20 to 25 years up to sort of that 30-year period. So even though those X's got into the market in the late sort of 2000s, they've probably still got a sizable loan they're paying off now, even 30 years later. So they're still carrying the burden of those high house prices even now.
And apart from settling a few maybe intergenerational or family debates, why do you think it's important for us to understand these kind of comparisons?
Basically, it's telling us that over the last 3 years, households have gone from having about 3% of their income going to interest repayments to about 6%. And that 3% is really causing a lot of cost of living pressures. It's people finding it harder to kind of do discretionary spending. It's putting them into financial stress. And it's meaning that households are spending less than other things, which stimulate the economy. So it's a bit of a macro indicator on how much households have to spend on other things, which sort of help employ people.
That's KPMG senior economist Terry Ronsley. He was speaking to Bridget Fitzgerald. Donald Trump's personal wealth grew enormously during his first year back in the White House, according to new financial disclosure papers. His family's cryptocurrency ventures alone raked in more than $1 billion for Mr. Trump. North America correspondent Lauren Day has been going through the papers.
Barb, there's almost 1,000 pages of disclosures, so it's a pretty extensive look at the president's finances, although I should say not entirely complete. But it does raise fresh questions about just how much his personal wealth has grown during his presidency so far. Overall, he raked in over $2 billion last year, according to analysis by the major newspapers here. And that compares to about $622 million in 2024, so that's more than three times the amount since re-entering the White House. And one of the most lucrative parts of the president's earnings are his crypto ventures. And that's interesting for a number of reasons, but in part because he was once a very outspoken skeptic of cryptocurrency. He once said that it was a haven for drug dealers and scammers, but now he's a major player. And he's made more than $1 billion from his family's crypto ventures at the same time that he's the industry's top policymaker. And we have seen that he's pushed crypto-friendly policies since taking off and lifted those Biden-era regulations since he re-entered the White House. So in a statement, the White House spokeswoman Anna Kelly said that he had turned America into the crypto capital of the world, but they denied that there are any conflicts of interest there. Donald Trump himself was asked earlier today whether he is profiting off the presidency. Here's what he had to say.
I don't get involved in my personal. We have funds that run my money. And I purposely, I never speak to any of the people that run the money. But they're at big institutions, and they invest in whatever they invest. Well, you know why I'm profiting? Because the stock market's going up. Everybody's profiting.
Everybody's profiting. Wow, quite the statement. But Lauren, it's not just crypto, is it? What else is the US president making money off?
Well, also included in this haul were, as you'd expect, millions in real estate deals overseas, including projects in Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Romania, India, all over the place. There were millions of dollars in sales of Trump-branded items like Bibles, sneakers, cologne, watches. Also royalties from his books, and interestingly, even a $6,000 monthly pension fund from the Screen Actors Guild from his time back on The Apprentice. It also revealed that he has earned $80 million in income from settlements with various media and tech giants that he's sued, including ABC America, Paramount, and Meta. And he's also received very lucrative gifts, including to sporting events. So it's been a very lucrative year for the president.
Lauren Day in Washington. And that's AM for today. Thank you so much for your company. I'm Barbara Miller.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. In the early 2000s, we had the mining boom. Now it looks like we're embarking on a data centre boom. It's helping drive economic growth. So, should we as taxpayers be getting a bigger cut of the profits? Today, independent economist Sol Eslake on how we're cashing in on AI. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.